when you look at the one of the highest crises at the border is the humanitarian. You look at all these unaccompanied children that are coming by. Over about a year ago, New York Times broke a story about 85,000 of them roaming around the country, many of them that had been displaced, and the government didn't have the ability to track them, the federal government. And a lot of them were found in child labor rings or sex trafficking activities. I mean, it's horrific. And then you have, of course, the families, and like you said, the women. And by the time they reach our border, they've gone a huge, long journey, many times tragic and horrific. And they get here to then again, be turned over to another part of what would be a horrendous life as well. So it's not, the migrants in most cases are not winning themselves either.
Americans are capable of achieving extraordinary things when they have the freedom and opportunity to do so. This is American Potential. And here's your host, Jeff Crank.
Thanks for being with us for another episode of American Potential. You know, we did an episode with Helder Tosti from Libre, talking about the history of the Hispanic vote and how more Hispanics are starting to run for office. Well, today's guest is one of those individuals who got elected to Congress and in the process made history because he became the first naturalized citizen from Mexico elected to the U.S. House of Representatives from Arizona. His family immigrated to the U.S. during his childhood, settling in Tucson, Arizona. His father was a hardworking bus driver who helped him learn to cherish the American dream and its promise of opportunity. Educated in Tucson's public schools, he juggled multiple jobs while securing scholarships to fund his education, and he became the first in his family to attend college, graduating from both Pima Community College and the University of Arizona. Throughout his professional career, he has remained committed to serving his community. And during his time at the Tucson Hispanic Chamber of Commerce, he advocated for reduced taxes and the streamlining of regulations to support small business owners. Having grown up in a border state and worked in the Arizona governor's office for 7 years as a senior advisor, he's seen firsthand the effects of border policies. I want to welcome Congressman Juan Sisgamani, who represents Arizona's 6th Congressional District. Well, Congressman, thanks for being with us. How are you today?
I'm doing great, Jeff. Thanks for having me.
Good. Well, listen, you've got a great American story. And, you know, one of the things I love to do is on this show is to tell the stories, American success stories, those great American success stories of people who come to the United States. They come here legally. They build a life for themselves. It just shows the greatness of our country. And you really have one of those. Your family has one of those stories. You were born in Mexico. Can you share the story of your family coming to America, what it was like growing up here in the United States as well?
Sure. Yeah. Well, thanks for highlighting that. And one of the reasons that I like to share my story is because, of course, I'm proud of my parents and what they did for us and gave us this opportunity, this amazing opportunity to be able to grow up here. But also because I think a lot of people can see themselves reflected in that story, whether they immigrated here or not, or maybe 4 or 5 generations ago, or just, their first generation. There's something about this country that has created so many American dream stories, whether, again, from immigrants or recent immigrants or not. It's just the opportunities that we have, that people take them and then they run with them. So in my case, my family moved to the United States in the early 90s when I was 11. And I have 2 younger sisters. We grew up in Tucson on the east side. And that's where my parents raised us. My dad worked all kinds of different jobs. And where he settled was as a bus driver. He did that for the school district and he did that for the city for decades. And I remember him just working hard every day, just getting up. He had the early shift, so about 4 a.m. And would go to work and never miss a day, never called in, just wanted to make sure that we had a shot at the American dream. My parents would always tell me, hey, we're doing this so that you can go on and take advantage of the opportunities. So fast forward, I graduated high school and I go to the community college spend a couple of years there. Then I go on to the University of Arizona, the U of A, graduate from there, and then go to the, I work at the Hispanic Chamber of Commerce, and then Governor Ducey at the time was elected, and I worked for him as part of a senior staff for about 8 years. And then on his last year, when he was turned out and I was just looking at different opportunities, then this opportunity came up to run for office. And it's something that we had been looking at, and the timing was right. The issues were prime for our focus. But I got to tell you, what the best way to kind of, you know, encapsulate here the story is, right before my new venture came out, my dad pulled me aside and he said, "Juan, I want you to think of something." He said, "Where else in the world could we have our story?" He said, "We come to the country, we immerse in the culture, we learn English, we go through the long process of becoming U.S. citizens." He said, "And now you have a shot of being a United States congressman? I mean, where else in the world could we have that story?" And the answer is nowhere else, right? This is the country of that opportunity, because we became citizens in 2006. 2006, it took us quite a while to do that. So to go from taking an oath of citizenship in 2006 to taking an oath of being a United States representative in 2022, I would say I'm very grateful for this nation and for my parents' efforts as well.
Yeah, that is an amazing story. It truly is. And as you were telling it, I was thinking about your dad. And, you know, him working hard, you said he never missed a day. Yeah. Just, you know, where else in the world can you be a bus driver, right? And make a living doing that. And your son becomes a congressman.
Yeah. Yeah. And then you add that during that time, there was a journey of immigrating. I mean, my parents, they speak English, but that's clearly their second language. We also had to perfect it and get better at it. Spoke a bit of it when we got here, but it's just an amazing country where you can become a citizen as an adult. Let's not forget that. Let's not, you know, let that get lost in the story here. In 2006, I was done with college at the time, Jeff. I mean, I had already completed a 1 year fellowship here in Washington D.C. as an intern on the Hill. I had done all that, and then after all this, I'm a green card holder this whole time. That's why I share the story that, you know, when I first came to the Hill, I had a green card, and now the member pin is a green pin. So I went from a green card to a green pin. Because that's just the way it worked out in terms of the timing. But, you know, in 2006, in my 20s, that's when I take the oath of citizenship. And I remember that day like it was yesterday. I mean, the room was packed. We take the oath. I had, you know, set the Pledge of Allegiance hundreds and thousands of times before, but never did it feel the way that it felt when I became a U.S. citizen. I say that it was the proudest day of my life, second only to the birth of my kids. And since I have six kids, that makes that day the seventh proudest day of my life. But, you know, you take that oath, and then 16 years later, I can take another oath, my second oath, as a United States citizen, as a United States congressman. I mean, no other country, like you said, would give you that opportunity to have that journey and that story of saying, "You come here, you know, my dad works hard, my mom works hard, they give me that work ethic," but also that foundation of faith and family that is very important to the Hispanic culture, that is very much in line and in tune with American principles. So it was just a great fit for us, and here we are.
So I'm sure that your parents are enormously proud of your accomplishments, but really it's their journey too, as you kind of alluded. Where else can someone, you know, come to the United States in the next generation? They've got a member of Congress as you know, representing them. Talk about your dad and your mom, and I guess I'm sure they're very, very proud, and I'm sure they speak of you often, I'm sure.
Well, they do. I'm the oldest and the only boy. So I always tease my sisters that they know that I'm the favorite, which
I'm sure.
Rivalry. But no, I mean, my sisters and I all know this, that, you know, my parents are proud of each one of us for the different ways that we've taken advantage of the American dream. My middle sister, she works for the electric company in town, so she chose private sector. She's been there for a while. My youngest sister, she works for a church. She's worked for nonprofits and for the foster care system before. So she's very much into service and giving back as well. So we've all chosen different paths on the ways that we have pursued our own happiness here in this country. And my parents are equally proud of all of us. And I tell them all the time, whenever they celebrate one of my accomplishments or my family's, my sister's as well, I tell them, listen, I know you're proud. Thank you for that. But here's the reality. Whatever I risk, whatever I go for, whatever milestone I reach or whatever effort I put into something, I'll never have to make the decision that you guys had to make, which was to leave their native country to go into a new country, unknown territory in terms of a new nation, start over just so that my family can have a better future. That's what my parents did. So it doesn't matter how much I'm able to do or others in my family are able to do, the hardest thing has already been done by my parents. So we stand on their shoulders, and that's why I'm so proud of them. And my like I said, my dad working 2-3 jobs at a time, and my mom always just being there. She also worked some side jobs. However, I would always say that her biggest contribution to my life specifically has been her praying, her always pointing me back to the basics of faith and belief in God. And that balance of my parents in my life and then the support of my sisters as well has been really why I'm here. I can't take credit for it. And then, of course, Laura, my wife, comes along, and she's a force, 6 kids. I'm very motivated by my family. So here we are trying to do what's right for our country.
Yeah. So let's talk about that a little bit. What made you get interested in politics and ultimately decide that you wanted to run for office?
You know, running for office wasn't really what I was aiming for the entire time. I saw my parents get involved in church. And then our family ultimately everybody got involved in church. We helped out in different places. We were volunteers. So the notion of service, the notion of just volunteering, of giving up of your time for someone else and something else was instilled in us at an early age. And that led into being involved in clubs in school. I played sports, really. That's what I did in high school. But then towards the end of it, I started getting more involved in different clubs. And then when I went to college, I got more involved and became student body president at the community college, at Pima Community College, then stayed involved in other clubs at the University of Arizona. So it just, you know, the involvement just kept there, the service, and that just made me realize that I really liked just the notion of serving. I was attracted to how much we could do to help our community from the government perspective, and having a right approach the right place for government. You know, working for the Ducey administration also helped me solidify that focus, understanding that the government doesn't create jobs, right? The government creates an environment where businesses can go and create the jobs, and they take the risk and they do that. It's not the government. So these politicians that are taking credit out there saying, I created so many jobs, or no. The government sets an environment where businesses go on, and they're the ones, the private sector, that create the jobs. So it was the fact that I feel like I understand the role of government well, the place of the government, where it should be and where it shouldn't be. And then I'll couple that with my passion of just serving and giving back and being part of something greater than myself is what drew the different steps into running for office. And it was a big jump. I mean, never been elected to any position outside of student council before, to running for the United States Congress in a district like this one that is very, very, split. I would say it's 1/3 Republicans, 1/3 Democrats, 1/3 Independents. So you have to just have common sense, talk to everyone, be open to ideas, have your own principles, know how to stand on them. So it's a unique and challenging district that I really enjoy representing, because it really reflects who I am as well. So it all kind of like fit in into the issues of the border and the economy. The time was right, and went forward, and here we are.
So now you're a freshman member of Congress, and you say you also spent some time were you an intern on Capitol Hill? Is that right? Yeah. So what's that like? I mean, tell me the difference, because I worked on Capitol Hill as well. Tell me the difference between being an intern on Capitol Hill and being a member of Congress. What's the experience been like for you?
It's been wild. I mean, the first time that I was here was in 2003 as a summer intern. And then I came back in 2005 and 2006 as a fellow. As a fellow, my responsibilities grew a little bit. I got to do more of the policy work, but still I wasn't part of the team. So I was still kind of a glorified internship, not what a fellowship was. So right. to go from that, and it's interesting that the decision I had to make, and this is where I met my wife, Laura, too. She was a fellow of the same program. The program selects 10 guys and 10 girls from the country. And she was one of the girls from California. I was one of the guys and from Arizona. So we met here, fell in love, and we went back to Tucson to start a family. She went to the University of Arizona at that time, graduated from Stanford on her bachelor's and then the U of A. So when we were here, it was very unique. And at the end of it, we had to decide, do we stay here and pursue a career in what we like to do, which is service, and we were attracted to what we did as our job here, or go back home and just start a family and focus on that. So we obviously chose the family route, and we did that. Little did I know that I was going to be back here anyway years later, but now as a member and not just an intern fellow or be able to work as part of a team here. But I did work the staff route, like I said, in the Ducey administration. So coming back here as a member, when I was sworn in just months before, I was part of a staff of an elected official. I have a very unique perspective because I can talk to anyone in this office and let them know that I've done their job from the intern that was answering the phone calls and taking care of our constituents all the way up to where I am today as a member. And I've done it all. Senior staff, fellow. I mean, I've climbed up, maybe not in this office, but in an office over at the state level. So two things. One, I have a high appreciation for what the team does because I've done it. I know the late nights, I know all the work, but I joke with them also that because I've done it is that I have high expectation of them because they can't tell me anything that, oh, this is harder or this. I'm like, I know I've done it. Yeah, so let's get on it. You know, so I've done all these things and it gives me a very unique perspective of where it is. But I got to tell you, I was senior staff with Governor Ducey for 8 years and I was right there with him, hundreds of trips with him. I did a lot of work around the country and even around the world also as taking care of international affairs. And I thought that I was just, you know, a step removed from the pressures that he was feeling because I took my job very seriously. It's a world of difference from being part of a team to being the elected official and your name on the door, the pressure, the balance of everything. I mean, it's a big, big difference. As much as that can prepare you, it's still a huge leap and a learning curve that we've been on here this last year and a half.
Yeah. Well, it's been an interesting place the last year and a half in Congress.
One word. Yeah.
To say the least, it's not as functional as it once was. It's not as functional as it was when you were there as a staff member.
Yeah.
The culture has degraded quite a bit. It's become, you know, a very hostile environment, even amongst Republicans. I think that there is this sort of, the sense that something's really wrong with the institution. The Republican Party has a 2-seat majority right now. And really anybody can just kind of blow any bill up if they really want to get a friend and get you a buddy and you can blow up a piece of legislation coming through from the majority. What have been your thoughts on what you've seen there and what's the best path forward?
That's a great question. Great couple of questions there. Yeah, there's been a huge and fast decline, I would say, over the last maybe 15 years or so since I was here as an intern in 03 and then 05, 06 to today. And of course, as an intern, you don't get to see all the axes and all that I know now. So in reality, I would say that I, in terms of being a member, I don't know anything else except the last year and a half. And I'm in the Appropriations Committee as well. I'm the only freshman serving on the Appropriations Committee, now appointed earlier in my first term last year. And I always heard that was the committee where the functionality happens, where in spite of everything going up and down and having cycles around that this was where the real business was done. One of my predecessors, Congressman Jim Colby, served in that committee for 20 years, and he's very respected in my district, and then came Gabby Giffords in the same district, and then Martha McSally, and then Ann Kirkpatrick, and then myself. So a couple of appropriators in that mix, serious legislators, whether they were Democrat or Republicans, always someone that were willing to work with people. They were willing to listen to both sides and actually get things done. That's the nature of my district. Like I described it, when you are one-third Republican, one-third Democrat, and one-third Independent, you have to show results, period. I mean, because you can't just go off the talking points on either side. You have to show depth and knowledge and actual willingness to work and a willingness to find consensus and realize that a win doesn't have to look like 100% of what I want. I wish it did. I wish that was life, but overall, that's not life. It's definitely not the reality in family. It's not the reality in business. It's not the reality here on the Hill. As long as we're advancing and winning, we have to be able to recognize that. And I think that's mainly what's missing here. I think there's an extreme partisan approach by some people that if they don't get everything they want, then they're walking away. And in this case, when they walk away, they don't just walk away silently. They walk away by making a lot of noise and dragging others with them. And that is what's feeding into the division. And of course, a lot of the attention is placed on the Republicans right now because we're in the majority. But I got to tell you, in the famous Reagan quote, the other side has issues too. And they do. And this is cyclical. If and when the Democrats are back in the majority, not next Congress, of course, but in the future, then the light's going to be on them. And trust me, they will have similar, if not worse, challenges than the ones that we're having. But right now, the responsibility is on us, and we have to govern. So my approach on this is just keep talking about business and reminding people that we have to find solutions. That people sent us here to find solutions, not find sexy tweets that will sell. You know, we got to focus not on the next social media post, but on the next generation. That's why I came here. So we got to get on it, though, because it's been a very, very up and down kind of year, and we need to show more progress. And on that note, let me just add one more thing. When we have a divided government like the one we have, the progress is not always measured on how much you were able to do. Not only that, but also how much we're able to stop. And the tax hikes that would be happening right now, the overspending that will be happening right now if we hadn't won the House. That's one of the victories also by being in the majority in the House right now.
Right. Let's talk about the border. I mean, that's what's really on everybody's mind is border security. I mean, this administration, the Biden administration, has literally failed to implement border security. I visited the border two times in the last year, not anywhere close to the number of times you've been there, I'm sure. But you know, when you talk to Border Patrol agents, they sort of feel betrayed by this administration. They're not able to do their job and they want to do their job. I was stunned to find out that there are more New York Police Department officers at NYPD than there are actual Border Patrol agents. And it just seems like this administration has failed the country on this issue. What do we do as a nation? And what do voters do? Let me ask you that. What do voters do, obviously, to hold the Biden administration accountable and elected officials, members of Congress accountable for the disaster at the border?
Yeah, everyone should be held accountable on this, especially the ones that are responsible for making this happen. I ran on this issue because the first 2 years of the Biden administration, we knew immediately where this was going. And we didn't have to guess. We saw the numbers spike to record numbers. And every time that during those 2 years the country felt that it had reached its lowest point, somehow the Biden administration found a way to find a lower point than the one previous. Last December was probably one of the worst points in our whole history as a nation in terms of the entries at the border and the gotaways and basically just the chaos and the crisis that we're seeing there. And you know, you quickly find out the role that the White House, that the executive branch placed in this, that is way more than anybody anticipated when they're not willing to enforce the law. Now, when you look at even the Obama administration, when I was with the Ducey administration in Arizona, we came in and Obama was president. And then we had 4 years of Trump. And then we had the last 2 years of the administration with Biden. So we actually got to work with three different presidents and in the governorship, which is very unique to be able to see the difference in all three. You know, we thought the Obama policies were bad, but then came Biden and said, you know, let me show you what bad really looks like. Because you got to remember, even Obama was coined by the Hispanic and Spanish media as the deporter in chief. And even he deployed the National Guard to the border to what then looked like a crisis. Now, when we're looking at what we have here, Biden hasn't done any of that. any of that. So he has basically opened up the border, not only through policy, but here's something that we don't talk about often, the messaging, Jeff, back home, to these people's home, back right. in the other countries, when he's basically telling them with the actions, the border's wide open. He may say the border's not open and don't come, but my gosh, the word gets back at home pretty quickly that anybody that makes it to the border, you have almost a 90% chance of getting in and staying with very little vetting because of the overwhelmed system. And the cartels are coordinating all this, and President Biden is straight up allowing it. And listen, we don't have to guess on this. We saw the policies that worked under the Trump administration that were done by executive order. And then equally undone by executive order came the Biden policies that now got us to this place. So my approach as a legislator, to answer your questions in Congress, we can be up and down through executive orders like this, whether they're good or bad, whether they're enforced or not. The point is that we are a nation that is governed by laws, and that's the role of Congress. We need to codify the policies that worked, that have worked, into law so that we can actually enforce them and gain control of the border again. Because right now it's just a straight up mess.
Yeah. What is stopping that? What's stopping Congress from taking action and passing that?
Well, we have, you know this, we have a system of checks and balances. So we have the Republicans have the House, the Democrats have the Senate. So Congress overall is obviously one third of government. So the Republicans have control of one half of one third of government. So with that said, the things that we can do, we've done a lot of this, which is if you look at the policy, we have passed the several bills like the border security bill last year. Several of my border security bills have passed with actually bipartisan support as well. And they've all gone over to the Senate to just be held up or die there. So the Senate hasn't taken action on these bills. That's a problem. So that's one area, the policy area. Then you've got the resources and the funding. Through the appropriations bills that I serve in the Appropriations Committee, like I said, we have put more money into hiring more agents at the highest level possible to finish money to finish the wall and so on. All this has been passed through the appropriations process to give the proper funding and the resources to the Biden administration to do what they need to do. As much as Congress would like to do the permits of the wall and go get that done, that's not allowed. The executive branch needs to go do that. So we've given them the tools to go do that. Let's see how much of that they do, which right now doesn't show that they've done anything. That's the second piece, the funding. And then the third piece is the accountability. We impeach Alejandro Mayorkas for his failures. You talked about Biden failing at the border. Absolutely, that's true. Along with that came the leadership of Alejandro Mayorkas, who has been impeached by the House after ethics investigation and Homeland Security investigation. It took a while. It wasn't immediate. People at home are running anxious, but it took over a year. We vote on it. We impeach him, goes to the Senate, and the Senate decides to not hold him accountable as well. So that doesn't mean that we stop doing what we need to do. We have to continue to press on all fronts. But listen, if the things stay as divided as they are right now between the House and the Senate, with Republicans only having the House and not the White House or the Senate, it's going to be very, very difficult to secure that border if the White House doesn't get on it. And there's more on them than anyone else. Because Biden could do it today, Jeff. Today, he could enforce these things. Again, I'm not a fan of executive orders. But if you really wanted to make a difference and were concerned about the border like we all are, do it through executive order now, and that's work and codifying it into law. But immediate action needs to be taken, and the president has decided not to.
Yeah. You know, when I was down at the border, I went to Catholic Charities, met with some of the folks that deal with this catastrophe at the border. And, you know, I looked in the eyes of some of the women who made that long journey and some of the children who made that long journey up. And you can tell some of the horrors that they saw. And we hear of this, the trafficking, the human trafficking, rape, torture, you name it, at the hands of some of these cartels that are out there. And the Biden administration bears the responsibility for that, because if the Biden administration sent the signal that people were not going to be able to get into the United States, they would not come. They wouldn't make that journey that they're risking their lives for. Your thoughts on that? I mean, to me, that's just immoral that as a nation, we're sending that signal.
Absolutely. I mean, when you look at the one of the highest crises at the border is the humanitarian one. You look at all these unaccompanied children that are coming by. Over about a year ago, New York Times broke a story about 85,000 of them roaming around the country, many of them that had been displaced, and the government didn't have an ability to track them, the federal government. And a lot of them were found in child labor rings or sex trafficking activities. I mean, it's horrific. And then you have, of course, the families, and like you said, the women. And by the time they reach our border, they've gone a huge, long journey, many times a tragic and horrific one. And they get here to then again, be turned over to another part of what would be a horrendous life as well. So it's not the migrants in most cases are not winning themselves either on this. Definitely we're not. Border Patrol is, and like you mentioned at the beginning, they've been abandoned by the Biden administration. So you got to wonder who's winning, who's gaining from this. It's the organized crime on the cartel side and the drug cartels in Mexico. They're the ones that are winning. And also all the other countries now that are starting to send people that are no longer these family units. They're single male adults in their 20s and 30s that are coming in unchecked. Many of them, when the Border Patrol gets busy with that family that you're talking about, helping these kids that have gone through the process and abused, and that takes resources, other parts of the border are unattended. And that's where these guys that are trying to really, really do harm to the country and not be seen or apprehended, they start moving drugs through. You got the fentanyl crisis in our country. So it is humanitarian. It is on national security. It is on our own health. It's a crisis any way you look at it. It's no one on this side is winning, including the migrants, like you mentioned, that are many times trafficked through this. And like we said, it's the messaging back home. If people were stopped and sent back, agents have told me this over and over again, Jeff, both the CBP, the ones in blue uniform at the ports of entry, and our Border Patrol that is in the desert and in the remote areas, they both confirmed this. During the time that Remain in Mexico was in place, which basically is people come in, check, claim for asylum, and instead of waiting in the country with a 3 to 5 year date to come back to see your judge, it was decided either in the moment or you waited in the Mexico side, then that disincentivized people from coming up because they knew that one, they probably didn't have a legitimate claim and they were going to be sent back and it was going to be decided within a week, or they were going to have to wait the 2-3 years, but on the Mexico side and not on the US side. And that wasn't attractive to anyone. So guess what? The numbers dipped incredibly low, at the lowest that we've seen. Why? Because the incentive was gone. The word got out that the entry wasn't guaranteed and things got better. But right now it's the opposite. Right now it's saying, just go, say these few things, and then you're going to be let in. You're going to be given a court date from 3 to 5, even 7 years. So show up if you want. That is the message that is getting out there right now.
Right, right. You introduced the Transnational Criminal Organization Illicit Spotter Prevention and Elimination Act. It's called the End the Border Catastrophe Act.
Yeah.
What does the bill do, and why did you think it was important to introduce that bill?
So it was important to introduce it because I'm not going to stop working on this, even if the road it looks bumpy or seems that there are a lot of challenges ahead of us on these bills because of the unwillingness of the Senate to actually pick this up, and even many Democrats here on the Hill. I have to keep on doing my job. This is what I was elected to do. So we passed what is called the HR 2, which is the border security bill, last year. Again, they passed on a partisan basis, Republicans voting for, Democrats voting against. We stayed united on that vote. And one of the last ones we did that with, and then got over to the Senate and went over to die. Since then, I've taken pieces of the HR 2 concept and passed them and worked on them individually. And one of them was to add penalties to drivers to end high speed chases. And people have died in that, both agents and also innocent bystanders. So that bill was broken up in just one section. It passed through the House with every Republican voting for it and 56 Democrats voting for it as well. So I started proving that you can take pieces of bills and actually get them through if you discuss and debate them individually. Of course, that bill went over to the Senate and it still hasn't moved over there, unfortunately. So this bill that we passed was on the same week that we were considering all the foreign aid packages as well. And I got up that week early in the week and I said, we have to have border this week. We can't be focusing on other things only without prioritizing our border once again. So the speaker was open to the opportunity and he said, do you have a bill ready? And I said, you betcha I do. And we that's when we put in this bill. It took a lot of the concepts of the former HR2 bill, but now with new information and the crisis having grown, we added some things in there, specifically around fentanyl that has continued to become an issue, and the high-speed chases and other things that were important to add on that bill. But border security continued to be a priority that week. Unfortunately, due to different processing gimmicks that some people played, it got the majority in the House, with even Democrats voting for it as well. However, it didn't meet a two-thirds threshold that it needed to pass, because it didn't go through the Rules Committee. It got put on the floor by suspension by the Speaker. And when that happens, you need a two-thirds vote. And it didn't reach that threshold. But if it would have been a majority vote, it again would have passed.
All right. Well, listen, I know you've got to run, Congressman. I really appreciate you taking some time to join us, obviously putting a lot of emphasis on what the American people are talking about, and that's the border and getting border security and holding this administration accountable. So appreciate that. Thank you for joining us. I appreciate what a great story you have, your family has, coming to America. We just need to hear more stories like that. Just thanks for your service in the U.S. House of Representatives.
Well, thank you. It's been a pleasure to be on with you. And one thing I'm going to leave you with is, as people are watching and they're thinking about their own stories, Jeff, of their American dream stories, because everybody has one. I'll never forget that as a kid, I used to wash cars with my dad on the weekend. And I would look at these houses and just think like, my God, these are mansions. I'll never be part of them. But my dad would always tell me, hey, we're working with these so that tomorrow you work with this too. Right. So just get going. Keep on working. Fast forward some decades later, we're cutting the ribbon in my office for this job. My dad reminds me, do you know where we are? And I'm like, I don't know. What do you mean, Dad? We're in my office. And he says, well, we're two blocks away from where we used to wash cars. It dawned on me that the same neighborhood where I washed cars as a kid is where now my office sits. So yeah, that everybody has a car wash story, though, if you think about it. So you do, from your parents, yourself, your grandparents. Somewhere along the line, someone broke through, went to college, joined the military, became a pastor, did something that gave us this chance of being here. And not only here physically in this country, but maybe generations in this country, that someone broke through and someone was able to start a business and make it big, or just provide for their families. It's an amazing country. Nowhere else could you wash cars in the same neighborhood where your office is going to sit for Congress just years later. But everyone has a story like that. So I encourage your listeners to think about this. What's your car wash story? What's your American dream story? Think about that. We'll be grateful. And I think that's going to make us even better citizens.
Wow. What a great way to look at it. Congressman Juan Ciscomani, thanks for joining us.
You got it, Jeff. Thanks so much.
You bet.
Thank you for listening to American Potential. You may listen to more stories from Americans working every day to expand freedom and opportunity in their communities by visiting AmericanPotential.com.